So let's go ahead and start in on a briefing. So we've got Mimi Phillips, PBOT, and Hillary doing the presentation.
Real quickly, this is Hillary. I just wanted to remind you that we are supposed to originally have this briefing on March 23rd, and obviously that was canceled, and so we are having this now. TriMet and PBOT will be back in front of you in about a month to talk about, to do their Section 106 consultation. And they will touch on that briefly at the end of this briefing. But I believe today our main presenters are Dave Unsworth, Teresa Boyle, and Fiona Cundy. So that's it for me.
That's right. Wonderful. Thank you, Hillary. On behalf of the TriMet team, the project team, I'm Teresa Boyle with the City of Portland Bureau of Transportation, and I am the manager for the city's involvement in this light rail project.
I'm Dave Unsworth. I work for TriMet, and I'm happy to be here back at the Landmarks Commission talking about our project. And with me from TriMet is...
Hi, everyone. My name is Fiona Cundy. I am an urban design project manager with TriMet. This is the first time I've been to the Landmarks Commission, so thank you for having me.
We're going to do a split here of in and out of a couple different people speaking once. And first, Teresa, you're up.
That's right. Thank you. And please just kind of wave your hands or something if I'm not speaking loudly enough. I know there can be a real difference in terms of volumes on people's systems. So first slide, please, Dave.
See on my first one of our...
Second slide, please, Dave.
Yeah, hold on.
Okay.
On my first glitch here.
Well, I can start. Anyway, yeah, as Hillary said, thank you. We were planning on coming to you in March with the this information about the conceptual design report. It's an opportunity for people to get a collection in one place of information about the project that's not engineering drawings. It's not environmental documentation. It really is a way to show what we think the vision of the project is, our understanding currently of the elements that make it up, and provide people with an opportunity to reflect on the information, comment on it, and this helps us prepare for moving further into a design process. Currently, we are going to be... Oh, Dave, next slide. All right.
Apparently, I have to enlarge my whole screen in order to do this, so I apologize.
No. So the last time we were with all of you was when we released the draft environmental impact statement in 2018. And since that time, we have been refining and completing our environmental analyses and moving the design of the project from about a 5% level to what would be considered 30% design this fall. That will come at about the same time that the environmental work wraps up and completes. And these things were all slated and calendared with an intent to be prepared for Metro recommending a regional funding measure that would pay for a portion of the project if it were passed in November of 2020. Obviously, with the pandemic and the upheaval that's occurring everywhere, Metro needed to take a little more time to deal with their own issues before considering taking this to the ballot. But that conversation will be happening this summer. And right now, we are assuming that the regional investment measure will be on the ballot in November. Regardless, as a project team, we know that we want to complete the environmental analysis phase and complete this 30% design. Those are super important milestones long-term for this project to be of to be poised to help if there is an infrastructure stimulus package. We have done this with prior light rail projects. When they have been ready, they bring work to the region quite significantly. So today we'll be sharing with you some of the information from the conceptual design report. As Hillary mentioned, we will be back in the middle of June, and that will be some of the more kind of formal environmental phase engagement around Section 106. And I think that's everything that I have for slides, Dave. So unless there are questions, I'm gonna mute myself, and you can take it away, Dave.
Thanks, Teresa. And because I've got PowerPoint up on two screens, I can't see faces here. So if there's a question you want to stop me, please do it verbally, because I can't see your faces at this point. So apologize for that. We came to Landmarks in July of 2018 when we're working, and we have lots of acronyms here. That was the DEIS period, or the Draft Environmental Impact Statement. What we heard from the commission at that point, Segment A goes from downtown Portland out almost to Bertha Boulevard. And so in that point, we had a couple different alignments. We had a NATO alignment versus a Barber alignment. And what we knew was that the NATO alignment had more impacts. We chose the Barber alignment. There was concerns raised for the Jewish shelter home, which is up near Hamilton Street. In segment B, which is what we call the Barber section, that was the old historical Barber, the B4 option had the fewest impacts, and we're moving forward with that. There was interest in providing input on Section 106 mitigations, and we are seeking that, not today, but in the June 22nd meeting, as we need to go through, excuse me for a moment, Section 106 is, from a national standpoint, our effects on both historic structures and archaeological issues. So we spent a lot of time going through that with the State Historic Preservation Office and other consulting parties. Why are we doing this? We are really, as a region, connecting the dots and trying to show where the density can occur and connect those with really high capacity transit, that being light rail or our frequent service routes and buses. And so since 1986, we've built 60 miles of light rail that connects our region. The next one that we're seeing is basically the Green Line that extends from Clackamas Town Center through the Banfield, through downtown, and would continue on through to Tigard and all the way to Bridgeport Village. So, and that's the project. It's connecting the dots. What is the project? It's 13 stations over about 11-mile area. It's travel, it's congestion-proof travel time, 30 minutes between Bridgeport Village and downtown. It'll be that in our opening day in 2027 and probably in 2050. Metro is forecasting there's about 37,500 riders in year 2035. That's the forecast year we need to use. And it's not just that, it's a whole bunch of other stuff that's associated and connected to it. What I'd like to do is have Fiona talk about the elements of the conceptual design report, or as we call it, the CDR. Fiona, why don't you take over and remind me every time you want me to pass on to the next slide.
Fiona? Sounds good. Thank you, Dave. So Fiona Cundy here. I'm going to hold up what is our conceptual design report. We had been distributing these pretty broadly throughout the community and with the commissions. I'm not sure if you received them, but they are all available online. And really, as Teresa mentioned, it's an enormous document that is full of graphics to help communicate what the project is moving forward. So up on the screen, we have what we call our four sort of core principles. We feel that these are the shared values of the region, and these will be sort of what we measure our metrics for the project against moving forward. So the four are move and connect people, maintain and create equitable communities, preserve and restore the natural environment, and design for the future. And I will also mention, if you're interested in learning more about these principles, there's an appendix to the conceptual design report that gets into what these actually mean and how they break down. And Dave, if you'll go to the next slide. So Dave mentioned we have about 11 miles of light rail If you'll notice the photo on the left side of the screen, I think this really sort of embodies what we try to do with these large high capacity transit projects. They're not just about transit, they're so much more. They're about creating really wonderful station areas and other related station access infrastructure. So on our project, we have about 10 miles of new sidewalks, about 6 miles of improved bike facilities. We have over a mile and a half of shared transitway. This is a stretch basically from Capitol Highway running north into downtown for buses. And we have up to about 2,000 park and ride spaces in our project scope right now. So I always like to sort of remind everyone what Barber Boulevard looks like today. It's two lanes in each direction, most of the corridor. There's many gaps in the pedestrian sidewalks and bike lanes. It's a pretty high speed corridor. So there's much to be improved upon with our project. Next we have sort of what our vision of these station areas is. So this image in particular sort of showcases what like a inner Barber Boulevard portion of the alignment looks like with, you know, safer sidewalks and bike lanes, as I mentioned, safer intersections, that center running light rail. There is a pretty significant amount of topography in the corridor. So we're looking at, you know, how to really make those architectural treatments and retaining walls have some value. Looking at facilities such as park and rides and how those might transition over time to future development opportunities and whatnot. So each of these elements are sort of highlighted in more depth in that report that we're talking about today. And this is just a quick cross-section to show, again, that sort of inner Barber Boulevard segment, what the actual components of that cross-section are. So again, two traffic aisles in each direction, center running light rail, a planting zone for utilities and street trees, raised protected bike lanes for safer bike movements, and a complete network of pedestrian sidewalks. We do have, so north of NATO, we have what we're calling sort of a constrained intersection cross-section. This is really just because this whole portion of the corridor has a huge amount of parks, which are Section 4F impact. So we're really trying to minimize our impact there. There's a huge amount of topography, and there is quite a bit of multifamily housing that we're trying to avoid impacts on. So it's really trying to say, where can we shave off a little bit of space so that our footprint for the project is minimized as much as possible? And Dave, if you'll go to the next. You know, station access is a topic that we've been having a lot of conversations with the community about, studying how people will get to their station safely, particularly through walking and biking improvements. Our project does, as I mentioned, have a huge amount of scope to improve that access. And we also have a series of station access projects that we're looking at, including in our environmental review. We are also thinking about how all the bikes, or I'm sorry, the buses will transfer and sort of connect to our station areas to provide better service for the whole region. And as I mentioned, we are thinking about different park and rides at station areas to really get sort of a further reach for transit riders. And Dave, I think this is your slide.
Yeah, it's Dave Unsworth again, and thank you, Fiona. So I think this project, more than any others, we're being asked to think differently about how we build infrastructure, how it addresses equity and housing affordability. And I think that really started back in the early 2000s. Metro, who led this, developed a Southwest Equitable Development Strategy. It applied for a federal grant, and it got it. It provided smaller grants to the City of Tigard and City of Portland to focus on housing, and listening to others, sharing the power from an equity standpoint, having coalitions come in and advise us. That really led in 2018 to the affordable housing measure that Metro put on the ballot. The City of Portland asked us to put it on a ballot for housing, but we really couldn't do that, so we pushed that over to Metro. Part of the outcome of that is an agreement between the cities of Tigard, Portland, Metro, and Washington County and TriMet to look at putting up to about 950 affordable units at station property that TriMet may own in the that TriMet may own in the future. And so we're willing and moving forward with that process. So we're not done. We're trying to make sure that what we build in a manner that benefits the community that's out there, that there are protections about displacement for both renters and for property owners. And that's been a big effort that the city and Metro and has pushed us on, and we're trying to answer that. We get it. TriMet currently has about 525 units of affordable housing on property that we own in teaming with nonprofits and the city of Portland and Clackamas County and others. So we get it. We know that if someone's located in a place where transportation costs are lower and the rent is lower, they're able to have more food and have more opportunities. So wanted to make you aware of that issue as well. For now, I'm going to hand it back to Fiona for a couple slides. Fiona?
Yep. So up on the screen is a map of the South Portland Historic District that I'm sure you all know very well. We just want to recognize that this is adjacent to our project alignment. And part of our presentation today will be sort of focusing in on the Gibbs Street Station area. So we are, you know, through our environmental review, identifying all the contributing resources in this area, and again, really trying to minimize our project footprint as we move north through this alignment. And so here is just a quick map of what we call segment A, sort of the northernmost chunk of our project alignment. There are two stations in this area, the Gibbs Street Station and the Hamilton Station. Really just looking at it sort of from the 1,000-foot level, you know, we do have Terwilliger Parkway to the left. We have that historic district to the right. We are trying to make a connection up to Markham Hill destinations, which includes the VA, OHSU. We know there's a huge amount of employment up here. And so a core portion of our project is really trying to make that connection better from our station area. So Dave, if you'll go to the next slide. This is looking at the Gibbs Station again a little bit more closely. This station is really pretty unique from all of the other ones that we were designing. And the main reason for that is that we have what's called a shared transitway. This is pretty similar to what you'll see down on the waterfront, where we have both buses and light rail accessing the platforms here. We anticipate from our ridership models quite a bit of people making this connection, getting on and off here to make that connection up the hill to Markham Hill. If you want to jump into Markham Hill a little bit more in depth.
Thanks, Fiona. This is Dave Unsworth again. And so I'm going to give you a description of this. This is the Gibbs Street Station. If you can see my cursor here, this is Markham Hill. On an average day, about 18,000 people want to travel up to the medical schools and the centers. And we're trying to figure out a better way of getting them from there. We see about 10,000 people getting off our train on our buses here, some of which go down to the South Waterfront, some of which come up to the hill. And so through this, we've had a very public process. We've had a Green Ribbon Committee that was made up of representatives of the community, architects, historians, engineers, who've helped us understand the impact that we could have on the Terwilliger Parkway. And so we had stakeholder a working group, and we had a series of open houses that informed how we thought about the connections that could go up there. What we recognize is Section 4F is a process whereby the Federal Department of Transportation rules require us to avoid impacts or minimize our impacts to parklands. In addition, the Terwilliger Parkway, given its heritage back to the Olmsted brothers, really is also a Section 106 resource as well. So it's got a double whammy of trying to get through the particular federal, state, and then local requirements that we need to move forward on. So a lot of consulting that's been going on the parkland area for Markham Hill. We looked at a couple different ways of getting up the hill, and I'll tell you that the one we picked was the inclined elevator after a lot of discussions about alignments, tunnels, bridges, escalators. Basically, you could see the Gibbs Street Station down here. We have a path, basically an elevator on rails that takes you up to Twilliger Parkway. There is also a work that OHSU is doing with ADA access to it, to a new high-speed elevators in a new building that's being constructed by OHSU, which we're teaming with for this improvement. This gives you a profile of what it looks like, gets you up to and allows you to cross Twilliger Parkway more quickly. Of course, Twilliger Parkway is a 106 resource, and we're working through that with the State Historic Preservation Office, as I mentioned. This is the 4F impact as we address that related to both the habitat and the parkland itself. This is the inclined elevator as it would look from being at our station. You can see how it connects up here. This is the head house and the view that it could be from Twilliger Parkway. We've looked at ways to minimize this. The views are very important. We're aware of the requirements up here. We've met a number of times with Friends of Twilliger. We're not done yet, but we know that from a conceptual size, this is about the size of this. We think we can reduce part of it as we move forward. We also looked at a couple different bridge and elevators. The bridge and elevators would either be one alignment that is A, or second alignment that is B, that is a shorter alignment. In the end, as we looked at these, and what you can see is this is about 12 to 13 stories tall. It had a pretty significant visual impact looking to the Markham Hill, from the Markham Hill and the parkway itself. And you can get that view here as you look at the height of the towers here. We'd have two elevators and a pretty long ramp that goes out here to get to the elevators itself. And this is the second alignment B that went to the turnout. Again, a pretty substantial elevator tower at that point. We also had a community outreach effort in 2020 before the pandemic closed things down. And what we heard was there were pretty strong support for the inclined elevator again. In consultation with our federal partner, the Federal Transit Administration, we spent a lot of time talking with parks, and we believe that the inclined elevator has the least impact on the Section 4F resource, and are working our way through the 106 process at the same time related to that. I wanted to give you a little bit of a flavor of what's to come for the commission and what we're asking you to do at your June 22nd meeting. It relates to both a little bit of Section 4F and the Section 106 process. The 106 process is basically a process where you go through and you identify what is potentially eligible for the historic, for the National Register. It doesn't have to be on the register. From our standpoint, from FTA, it just has to be eligible. We will do a lot of consultation with the State Historic Preservation Office or the tribal offices. And it also involves the public. And the first thing that we're doing is we're going through, and for all the properties that are potentially adjacent to our alignment, we're going through and determining whether or not they're eligible for the National Register. And with that, we're also consulting again with the SHPO and the Indian tribes. Part of the hard part we've had is the Indian tribes were not able to access them during this pandemic per rules from our FTA standpoint, so we're waiting for that to occur and to get finalized. The next thing you do is you determine the findings of effect. What is the effect on this light rail line, the bike paths going through, and the sidewalks? What's the impact on these potentially eligible properties? And that also could be noise, could be visual, could be a number of different issues. Then the last thing that we do is we try and resolve those adverse impacts. And so our team will come up with, our team supported by archaeologists and historians will come up with what we think are appropriate mitigation measures to minimize and to mitigate the adverse impacts. We'll work through that with our Federal Transit Administration and the SHPO, and then we'll be consulting with a number of different groups. Landmarks is clearly one of those. Friends of Terwilliger is one of those. Restore Oregon is one of those. And I'm sure we'll have a number of open houses where we seek input from the public about the impacts that we are seeing and the mitigation that we are proposing for the project. This also now goes through kind of the section 4F, which is it's building structured object sites and districts. And it talks about how you go through what is the determination eligibility. Is it an event, a person, something specific about the design, the construction, or potential for that. The adverse impact is found when you alter directly or indirectly affect the quality of that resource. And then it's the examples of adverse. Are we removing the building? Are we affecting the whole site? Move from its location, change in the use or the setting, additions if it's really noisy, neglect, or transfer. So there are a number of things that could result in an adverse or a finding of effect, if you will. So where are we with this project now? I've got two more slides and I'll open up for questions. We believe that we have, we've got 67 properties that have determined eligible and that we're looking at findings of effect. So for each one of these that are eligible, we have to determine an effect on that. We're waiting till the SHPO confirms, but we think there's probably about 11 potentially adverse effects, including the South District, because we're affecting some of the resources in that as well. So our intent on the meeting on June 22nd, if there's a preview for it, is we'd like to review the properties that certainly are determined to have a finding of effect. We want to review and seek comment on the mitigation that the project is proposing. That would be included in what's called a memorandum of agreement. That memorandum of agreement is between the State Historic Preservation Office and FTA, who's the federal grantee at this point. So where are we with the project? And an overall kind of view, we are hoping to publish our environmental impact statement in September, October of this year. We're wrapping up our 30% designs. We have the question of, will the public fund that in November? If they do, we start moving on our 60% designs. And then at that point, we'd be going through local land use actions. So clearing from a standpoint of where we have land use action, and I'm sure we'd be coming back to the Landmarks Commission at that point if we are affecting or how we're affecting in a potentially a historic eligible resource. So I wanted to stop there. I think that's my last slide. Oh, what's next? Yep, sorry. On the 22nd, we're coming back to you probably for a pretty much longer meeting. I'm sure you've got lots of questions for us. The regional funding measure, then landmark actions that happen a later date. If you want to know where the CDR is, it's at the trimet.oregon/southwest corridor. So I'm going to stop now, and that was a whole bunch of stuff going through, and stop and see if there are any questions that you have for our team. I'll take a breath. That was a lot.
This is Kristen Miner. I wanted to thank you all for a really good presentation. Just as an aside, as an urbanist, I guess I have a terror that what we're going through right now is going to negatively affect cities, in ways even aside from funding, and economics. I'm just worried that people are going to be not as inclined to live closely together. And so I just have a deep hope that this project can still happen. I do have some questions, and my fellow commissioners may have some as well. Maybe I'll just go ahead and start with one and then, give somebody else a chance. So I did have, so this is probably a pretty quick question. You showed a slide, in our booklet that each one is numbered, and it was on page 27, and it was kind of showing the community feedback. But I didn't really understand what the question asked was. I mean, were you weighing, you know, asking people to weigh the, you know, the effect, or was it about their own commute? What was it you were asking them to get that community feedback?
Yeah, so there was an online survey, and there were a number of open houses that happened just before the close down that happened with the pandemic. And so you were offered some choices. We would show you the bridge and elevator, and there'd be a description of what the bridge and elevator could or could not do, the length and height of it. So there was a scenario that presented for each one of those, and that we were asking and seeking the public's input on. Do you support this a lot, a little, some? And so it was a way of getting some feedback. We do a lot of outreach, open houses, the neighborhoods. We're finding that the online surveys that we do with the videos that we're able to put up there, we get thousands more responses, and they're not scientific, we know that, but nor is a public meeting or a neighborhood association as well. So it's one of the tools that we're using to inform the design and help our steering committee made of elected officials make a decision.
Dave, I would just add that I think the slide that Commissioner Miner is referencing is looking at each station area, and there's sort of like a blue and a red gradient. And the question was, how well does this station serve you? And so that was really good feedback that we got, so that we can continue our station area design. And we got 18,000 online views from our website, and we have about an additional 1,000 comments of extra comments on how we can make a particular station serve someone better.
Okay, thank you. I have a few more questions. Please, though, if there are some other commissioners who'd like to go ahead and ask anything.
This is Commissioner Spears. I would just get a little clarification. I'm very excited about this whole opportunity. Same as Kristen, I want to echo the same thing. I'm a little, you know, nervous about what's going on right now and how that impacts a lot of this, but I think that's the continued sentiment. I love the inclined elevator idea. When it comes to the bridge and elevators, are you also doing those and choosing between alignment A and alignment B, or are those no longer on the table?
It's one or the other. So the challenge was, how do you get from the Gibbs Street Station up to Twilliger Parkway in the most efficient way? And looking at how do you have the least impact on the built, on the natural environment there. And after, I would say 6 to 8, almost a year and a half of looking at this, we've come to the conclusion, along with our federal partner, and I think the City of Portland Parks, that the inclined elevator has less overall impact on the park, mostly because of the views. The views were something pretty substantial, and there's a view corridor, protected view corridor in that area. And if you go back to the Twilliger guidelines that looks at protecting that area, we felt that the inclined elevator had less of an impact. So it was one or the other. I think we're moving towards the inclined elevator after a lot of public input.
Perfect. I love that idea. And from traveling overseas and other places, you see a lot of funiculars and inclined elevators in other places. And it's a very big for tourists. It's a place you want to go see, and you get some nice views and things like that. So I love the idea. Thank you.
Okay.
This is Kristen Miner again. I have a bit of a follow-up to that, which is, it's definitely been a while since I personally have worked on a Section 4F, but I do know that the historic properties also trigger 4F. So it's not just the natural areas, it's the potentially, is it also Terwilliger itself? That,
yes.
Okay.
Jerry, okay. You're exactly right. If there's an adverse 106 resource, it falls into the Section 4F. It becomes a Section 4F impact.
So I actually felt that the inclined elevator was a good solution as well. I did have one concern about it that I wanted to bring up, which is just that from Terwilliger, you know, if that is a place of maximum concern and we're kind of looking at those views, the big glass roof over the top of that station, you know, where the where the elevator stops at the very top there. Just how it's shown in your early renderings, I have some fear that it won't really allow for views through it very well. And so, you know, keeping in mind the romance of Terwilliger and all of that, I hope that you can find a way to provide, you know, something that opens up four views and creates as minimal, you know, obstruction of views as possible.
We'll take that back. I think there are really, there's crime prevention through environmental design issues. There's the Terwilliger Parkway guidelines. There is, you know, we heard from Parks this morning about bird friendly, you know, and so, and there's weather protection. How do you manage all of those? And I think, so, and recognize this is at 3% level of engineering. So we're taking this feedback that we're getting from the Section 10 process, from this, from Parks, and we'll engage in a much more thorough and more detailed review of what does a head house need? How do you really celebrate the Olmsted vision of this? You know, I can imagine that we'll end up with some signage or a plaque or something up here that reflects and harkens back to what this place was when it was first initially thought about. So we got a lot of work, and I'm sure that we'll be back in front of the Landmarks Commission on this issue as well. Teresa?
Yeah, so thank you, Commissioner. We also have not been to Design Commission yet with this, so I'm anticipating years of conversations about what this looks like, in part especially because it is so new for all of us, this type of mode of transportation, but it is in such a sensitive place. I would like to just make sure that I understand for my own kind of note-taking, when you speak to views, are you just help if you would frame your concern for me? Is it the obtrusiveness of the thing in Terwilliger Parkway and the ability to look beyond it to the east, or just if you'd tease that out for me a little more, I would love to know.
Sure. And I probably should have read the Terwilliger Parkway guidelines and looked at the background a little bit more before this and prepared myself. But to my recollection, there's a lot in those guidelines about views as one is traveling along Terwilliger. And of course, a lot of it is written for the perspective of somebody traveling in a car. I'd like to see a lot more about, you know, pedestrians and bicyclists, although those are accounted for as well. But just sort of, you know, getting those views through the trees and having things open up, and suddenly you can see Mount Hood, you can see over the river, and, you know, allowing for, you know, this beautiful natural landscape that then allows for these more distant views. And so hopefully this is just that opportunity, you know, to allow for views and not, you know, and not obstruct that view as you're, you know, putting that roof on that structure.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And for one who has not perhaps read that information recently, everything that we have done with our recent research says that indeed that's the type of consideration that we will be needing to work with. We'll be back with you on that in the future for sure. Thank you.
And may I jump in and echo kind of what Kristen is saying as well? This is Commissioner Spears. I'm not an engineer. I'm not an architect. I don't have any background in any of that. I'm just a dreamer. Things that are out there. I think about like football stadiums and places where you want to integrate indoor, outdoor, and they have retractable roofs and restaurants and things like that. And I'm not sure if that's a consideration, what that looks like with funding, but something that could, you know, retract itself on the beautiful days so that you can get those beautiful views. And then when it's cloudy and stormy, it closes itself back up so you can then be functional, what you need it for. So I'm not sure if that's something that's a consideration, but and again within budget, but just something, maybe a thought that's out there that helps kind of blend the two things together so you can still get the canopy but also get the views when we have the beautiful days out there.
Thank you.
This is Commissioner Mahoney. I have a question regarding the June 22nd meeting. Dave, you had mentioned 67 properties identified. Are we going to be seeing each of those properties at that time? What do you expect, I guess, from us? And are we able to review that information ahead of time?
Yes. Yeah, so Hillary has asked us to get information to you ahead of time. Our intent is to do that. It's really a question of how deep a dive does Landmarks really want to get. My thought is that we probably more focused on the ones that have a finding of an adverse effect, because those are the ones that are most likely to be impacted. And my other thought was that you'd want to focus on the mitigation strategies in the memorandum of agreement. We are more than happy to, and we've got historians and architects who are more than happy to go through all 67 of the properties. Not all of those are in the city of Portland, but it really is a question to you and your team as to how detailed you want to get in. I think we will have, we're bringing a professional staff. I'm not a historian, nor I'm an architect or an archaeologist, but we'll bring those people to the meeting and be ready to do a deeper dive as you'd like. We'd look to get some direction from the chair and staff to figure out how much time you really want to spend on this. And I think it's an important discussion. There are some adverse impacts, meaning that some buildings that are potentially eligible for the historic the list will actually be removed. And so there will be an impact to the South Portland district as well. And part of the mitigation may be we look at that again and see how can we update the district and the resources in there. So there's a whole bunch of ideas that we've got, but we really are going to be looking to present those to you after we've at least shared that with the SHPO to get your reaction and get your input on, do we have the mitigation right? Does that help?
Yeah, thank you. And I guess a follow-up question based on your comment about the impacts to South Portland Historic District. I'm aware of also some projects happening at the west end of the Ross Island, which will also potentially affect that neighborhood. And I'm curious if that has been studied, the timing of those projects, and if there's, I guess, just the results of the combination of those happening potentially at the same time or in sequence, and if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I can. Thank you so much. I was just making a note to myself to not forget to bring up at the end, kind of in the last but not least, the City of Portland PBOT is working on concepts with ODOT to take that remaining stretch of NATO Parkway from where it meets Barber up to Southwest Harrison to bring it into a Main Street type of road as opposed to a old highway remnant. Doing that, we would also be reorganizing how NATO itself connects to the Ross Island Bridge. And if you'll show the, Dave, I was thinking actually of the historic district, the one that shows the outlines of the historic district. I have to put my glasses on because I can no longer see. There you go. That's it, 16. Thank you so much. So we do definitely plan to come to Landmarks with the project as a point of information, since we are within the district itself. At this point, we believe the project would be completely contained within the public right-of-way that ODOT owns. But where the project is at is it's less evolved than the light rail project, which will be at about 30% design. We're probably in that 5 to 15, setting a footprint, understanding operationally how it would work. And it would be part of the funded improvements if the regional funding measure passes in November or at another point. It's a project that the City of Portland would take up. We believe that its design and construction time would be faster actually than the light rail project, so that we could get out and do that work beforehand. So we absolutely will be coming to you and sharing more that's specific to that project. So we're calling it right now NATO Main Street, sometimes NATO Main Street / Ross Island Bridgehead for the big mouthful that it is, but it will be a PBOT project. done in conjunction, but likely in advance of construction of the light rail project.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is Hillary. Dave, could you just show with your mouse exactly what would be taking place there?
Ooh, it's more complex than that. So let me go back to this one over here. Sorry. Maybe it's the same drawing. There's a reconfiguration of basically how you get to and get off. You can see where we're trying to reestablish the grid. So NATO Parkway doesn't allow people to really walk across it. You're playing Frogger, if you will, trying to get to the Darlene Hooley Bridge. So we're putting traffic signals in here, and we're taking, you can see all of the ramps that go in here. They're being tamed, if you will. There now will be regular streets that connect in there rather than these very large higher speed ramps. That's the best synopsis I can do and without pulling out the plan drawing. So trying to tame, if you will, the ramps that go through this neighborhood.
So as Dave's right, you can see between the word NATO and the Ross Island Bridge, gray streets that actually don't exist right now. The idea is that we're able to eliminate the Highway 26 connection that is represented by those ramp loops that are in pale pink underneath the grid in that area, that we believe effectively will free that up for future development, hopefully of housing, and we'll have regular street crossings. We will have a normalized sidewalks and bike lanes and street trees and all of those things that really make something a main street as opposed to a piece of freeway. The traffic reorganization can't be exactly seen from this, but it basically keeps the US 26 traffic on the edge of the neighborhood to and from the Ross Island Bridge. Dave's hand is tracing it using Kelly. And then the other really big one is I-5 North traffic that currently gets on the Ross Island Bridge by going through the neighborhood. It would come around and connect in at Kelly as well. So it eliminates all of that driving through the South Portland neighborhood that is happening now. And we've also managed to do, through the use of traffic signals, the streamlining of the flow of traffic northbound in the evening from Barber Boulevard to east on the Ross Island Bridge. So instead of the courtesy queuing and all of that stack up of traffic, we've found a way to make that operate really smoothly. So the intent behind the project was get that regional traffic to the greatest extent possible out of the neighborhood and reconnect the neighborhood and make it a place where people want to be and feel safe walking and cycling and enjoying their area. So we're actually really excited about it. This is for anybody who's been in Portland and done any level of planning. You all know this is like from the 1970s that we first started looking at how do we crack this nut, and we think we've got it. So if we can fund it, we're going to build it.
Okay.
This is Kristen Miner again. I'm looking forward to learning more about your mitigation strategies. I have two thoughts right now that are kind of, you know, veering towards that, but, you know, they're not very fleshed out. It's just sort of a first blush. And one of them is really about your housing goals. So you had put up, you know, a slide with a bunch of housing goals, which is terrific. You know, anytime we fund public transportation, you know, it should get denser, and we believe in that. But I guess my question is really, right now, is everyone thinking that all of those new affordable units are going to be built new? So what I'd like to push is the idea that at least some of those could be put within existing buildings with, you know, seismic energy upgrades, and that we, you know, really put some money into those older buildings and, you know, at the same time ensure that those are affordable units moving forward. And then my second thought is really just about all the survey information that has been done as part of this project. I would like to see that go into the City of Portland's database. You know, we reached this point of sort of trying to set up a city database on the hopes that eventually we're going to pass a historic resources code project that allows us to grow, you know, what we refer to as the HRI, the historic resource inventory. It's just a capturing of, you know, eligible project or data about properties. And so I would really hope that all of your data can ultimately be put into that city database that's, you know, currently captured as part of Portland Maps. I mean, it's nothing you can really see, but it's behind the scenes, and we're hoping it'll go live, you know, at some point. So those are my two thoughts.
Chair Miner, I think we're more than willing to share the great research our team has done. We've done a deep dive on all the properties that are around here and pulled together a whole bunch of information that we're sharing with the SHPO in their format. It's mm-hmm. digital, easy to share, more than willing. It's public record stuff, more than willing to team with the City of Portland for that. I think would be someone else's to put that into the databases, however you've got them organized. I would think, though, that they should mirror what the state records are at some point. So that's the sure. second question. The first question, what TriMet's doing is it's got property it may have for staging around stations. And our thought was, you know, we need staging areas after we're done, we dispose of that property. And what our partners asked us, can you dispose of that in a way that helps affordable housing? And that means building new housing with the Housing Bureau and other resources. And we've said yes. There is other money, the $635 million that Metro raised, that hopefully will go to unregulated affordable housing, which there is a lot of in this corridor. How do you purchase that before the prices go up so much and protect it? It's less expensive to do than brand new spaces. That brand new door is $150,000, $160,000 per space. So how do you do that? We're partnering with Prosper Portland, Metro, City of Tigard, and the Housing Bureau on trying to make sure that some of these things occur. So TriMet's not leading it, but that I think is being led by our partners at the city and Metro to help move forward and build a holistic project that serves as many people as possible.
I appreciate very much your perspective on that, Commissioner. I will make sure that in our conversations with Housing Bureau here at the city and Prosper as we continue to move forward, that we can get that point of view incorporated. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Commissioner Foti. I just wanted to, I had the same question, Commissioner Miner,
about the survey. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Can you, you guys hear me now?
Better.
Maybe I'm not speaking in, sorry. It was the same question that I had regarding the survey information in what format that's in, and maybe that could be considered a mitigation. I think it's just that's such valuable information that we've been trying to get, and maybe that's yep. something that's part of this project is getting it into the HRI. Wouldn't that be exciting? It would just be a win-win and maximizing all that work. So it was a good question. Thanks.
Yeah, and we can raise that. You've got an opportunity on the 22nd to raise that again with our team to make sure that occurs. I will I'll leave you with one change that has happened to the project, which is the viaducts that are the Vermont and Newbury viaducts that are likely to be eligible for the historic National Register. We've come to the conclusion that given what's occurring there, that we're probably going to remove those. And so the mitigation for that is to do a number of different things, photo documenting, engineering record, and looking at some landmarks that go in and on this property itself. So that's the kind of stuff that I would expect that you'll hear on the 22nd as we talk about the memorandum of agreement and what our strategy is for addressing these. This was really a lot of added cost to the project to tear down these and replace these viaducts, but it was deemed that from an engineering standpoint and fact that none of them had bike or pedestrian on them, they really didn't work for the community. Now it's what's the appropriate mitigation that we need to address. So part of that going through this next meeting on the 22nd will be maybe we focus on the adverse impacts and the mitigation. And if you want us to dive on the other 67 properties or the whole 67 properties, please let us know and we're willing and able to spend as much time with us. You'll get sick of us, if you will, on going through some of the stuff. So anyway, I wanted to at least bring that up. That was a change from our meeting that happened in July of 2018. So I know we're over time, way over time. Okay. Wanted to thank you for your time and attention to this. And again, if you've got any other questions, we're stuck at home. We're not going anywhere. We're here to answer those.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate this thoughtful presentation. And, you know, definitely, as people have mentioned, really looking forward to hearing more and getting, you know, into the details with you. I will talk to Hillary about what level of information is appropriate for us to review in June, but certainly MOA and adverse impacts. So, you know, that'll be more than enough, but maybe we add more to it. I'm not sure yet. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for your time today. Appreciate it.
This is Hillary. I have a thought on the information that you could provide, and I just wanted to get it out there because we do have 3 minutes. But I was thinking it would be nice to see a map that showed with pinpoints all the properties, perhaps along the whole route, but we're really focused on Portland, of course. And then with the properties that you know would have an adverse impact or the ones that might maybe have a little bit more detailed information on those, indicating whether they're contributing resources, landmarks, or simply eligible. And if it was organized in that way, I think we could focus our discussion.
Yeah, so I think what we would, that's great advice. I think what we would start with were section maps that show the 67 locations of those. Of where they are, we'll have photos of all of the 11 and talk about the eligibility of those and what the effect of those are. And I think we can go from there. And probably in our back pocket, I think we would have more. So we've done a ton of research, a ton of information. I'm really glad to hear someone else wants it other than CHIPA, because we spent a lot of money in putting together these determination of eligibilities, researching deeply into who was there, what do we know about these different properties? And I think it's got value to go above and beyond that. I think then the memorandum of agreement, lease draft where we are, it's possible that we will not, because of the concern that we've got with the tribes and not being able to really require them to their 30 days. Now it's, you know, whenever they get back to us, we may not be able to finish the memorandum of agreement, but I think our intent is to share that, consult with you to make sure that we've got it as close to being right as we're working with the SHPA at the same time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Hi, this is Commissioner Mahoney. I have a request as well. I am not a historian, architectural or otherwise, and I'm not so very familiar with Section 4F. I know Section 106 a little bit, but it would be nice to get a little bit of background from somebody on those processes and then an idea of mitigation strategies that might be part of those MOAs, yeah. Just kind of a educational for us so we can provide feedback.
Be happy to do that. You know, I blame everything on Robert Moses. So Robert Moses is one who I think the whole National Environmental Policy Act was written for. It's a man who went through wetlands and called them swamps. He went through neighborhoods that were underprivileged. He went through old buildings and went through parks. And so over the years, there have been rules put in place, an opposite and equal reaction, if you will, which is to say you should protect parks. You should protect historic buildings. And the 106 is really to protect archaeological, wildlife, archaeological and built environment. The Section 4F is there to protect parks, wildlife, refugees, and really historic elements as well. And through that, there are a number of procedures you need to take. And we'll be glad to provide a primer or a primer on that, on both of those as we start our discussion at the next meeting. From the MOA, we had the opportunity to do a number of these, acronyms, Memorandum of Agreement. We've had the opportunity to do a number of these with the Historic Preservation Office. It's really about documenting. It's really about how do you make sure that you've captured the essence of what was there and why it was there for the determination of ability. If it's an impact, how are you addressing it? So potentially on Markham Hill, Twilliger Parkway, I can imagine as doing the least harm, which comes back to Chair Miner's standpoint and question about the visual impact of the head house for the inclined elevator. The next point will be, how do we recognize the historic nature of the parkway? How do you tell part of that story? As we've talked to the tribes, we've been down and talking to the tribes, their point is, don't tell us about all the historic stuff about the tribes, tell us about how the tribes are integrated in our society today, which if you look at our bridge that we put across the Willamette River, the Tillicum Crossing, we reflect that in many different ways. So we've got some history of doing this with the tribes and the SHPO, and we will use that past knowledge in helping to inform what we think are the appropriate measures for the mitigation. And just to remember, though, in the end, it's not our environmental documents, the Federal Transit Administration's document. We're trying to make sure it's as close as possible. In the end, it's a consultation between the State Historic Preservation Office and the Federal Transit Administration Office. So, boy, I'm saying way too much stuff here today.
Dave, why don't we connect with Hillary outside of this meeting and see if there's some sort of basic written materials that we could provide in advance of the meeting on the 22nd so that you guys can spend the bulk of your time anyway at that meeting focused on the actual properties. I'm sure we've got great summaries and explanations, and that might be helpful sometimes to be able to read something like that in advance. So we'll talk to Hillary about it. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, this is Commissioner Mahoney. I appreciate that, Dave. And I think that would be wonderful to have some backup material to get, you know, the baseline understanding at least in place. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks again for your time, everyone. We really appreciate it. And the project will be back in the middle of June.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. So I think we're going to have a little period of time here with some people getting off the meeting and some new people coming into the meeting. And I'm going to just turn my screen off. And we are looking to start the next item at 3:05. So if you could be, you know, back live a minute or two before that, commissioners, that would be great. Does that sound good, Hillary?
Sounds great.
Okay. See everyone soon. Thank you.